Welcome to today's episode of Notes from the Audiophiles. Why don't I like classical music? This is Carmen.
This is Pinky.
And we're so happy you have decided to stick with us for our third episode on improvisation. In fact, Brooke, we are improvising right now, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're improvising our conversation, and it turns out that every one of us in the world today is able to improvise, and I think we, as one of my professors described it, when oftentimes when we think of improvisation, two four-letter words come up, and those are fear and jazz.
I was going to say jazz has to be one of them.
Yeah. and especially for classical musicians, improvisation will definitely strike anxiety into our hearts, because rarely, you know, hardly any of us are brought up in our musical educations learning how to improvise, feeling that freedom. And yeah.
I'm just going to jump in here.
Yeah, go for it.
As you know, somebody who was trained in the classical style early on, it took, but like who also, I wound up playing rock and jazz and free jazz and all that. It took a long time and work just to get over, not necessarily to learn to actually play what I was improvising, but to learn to let go of the anxiety of improvising was something that was really challenging. And I wasn't really able to do it until I was about 20.
Right. Well, that's a lot sooner than a lot of other classical musicians. Some of them never, ever even approach the subject in their playing.
Which is a shame, because I think if music is all about, like, self-expression, is music about self-expression or, like, playing notes on a page?
Perfection,
is what
yeah.
it comes down to.
Yeah, definitely. When I was doing my doctorate, I took this incredible class for grad students, for non-jazz grad students, about improvisation, and it just completely opened up my world, and it made me a better classical player, because my ears were so much more attuned to what I was expecting to hear and what actually would happen. So I remember in the rehearsal, we were playing some Beethoven symphony, and you know, it goes along, my ear was expecting something, a certain chord to happen, and Beethoven did something completely different.
Yeah.
And it was like an epiphany. That was the first time that I had had that experience. And it really, I was so excited to be using my ears in that way. And it has changed my playing for the better, absolutely. I think it's integral to every musician's training, but there's a lot of work to be done in the institution to get that across. So I like to start with this quote that I found that in an interview with Fred Frith, who happens to be a professor of composition at Mills College in the Bay Area, and he's talking about improvisation. He says, "In the end, improvising is what we all do. It's how we get through life, even within the rigid structures where we may have to work. I like to keep the focus on improvisation as the act of making stuff up. When you do it with other people, then all kinds of social aspects come into play, and mostly the qualities that make a good improviser are not dissimilar to the ones that I appreciate in my friends, such as being a good listener, sensitivity to your social surroundings, being there when you're needed, but knowing how to step back too, knowing when to be supportive, when to be assertive, when your opinion is valuable, when to just go along with something, when to insist, patience, tolerance, openness." That paragraph spoke to me when I read it, and I thought, oh my goodness, what a great reason to keep music in the schools, for one. And improvisation not only teaches us to be more comfortable with our instruments and less tied to a page of written music, but it also teaches all these other skills that are applicable to everyday life. The professor that I had in grad school was Dr. Christopher Azara, and he's got a terrific TEDx talk available that he did in Rochester, New York. And it's about 20 minutes long, and he talks about this, the improvisation, and it's a terrific use of your 20 minutes. But he wrote an article in which he says, improvisation is analogous to the extemporaneous expression of ideas in language. Even if you're not a musician, I think we lose that sense of freedom in our everyday actions in life, right? Mm-hmm. Like we begin as children and we are improvising all the time. Everything is new. We're trying out things. We're eating dirt.
When you think about improvisation, or like the ability to improvise, is the ability to adapt to change when things don't go according to plan. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk recently in like pop pedagogy about grit and how students need to develop grit. And I think improvisation and grit really go hand in hand, because grit is just all about hanging in there and, you know, right? Like when you're encountered with challenges, you work around them or you work with them. And that's a part of improvisation. Because challenges are not what we expect or what the challenges wind up being.
Well, in some challenges, yeah, they force us to be resourceful, and then maybe we end up with an even better idea than we originally set out to pursue. Mm-hmm. There's another article I found on WQXR.org, and it is entitled, Why Don't More Classical Musicians Improvise? They quote Clive Brown, who says, one of the factors that makes classical music seem stuffy and less interesting to young people is this rigidity with which we play it now. More or less every performance is tied to notation. But I also think that that's not just classical music, though, I think. Mm-hmm. That's almost every music that we hear on the radio today.
Well, yeah, if you think about, like, classical music has the notated score, but popular music has the record album, and a lot of times artists are assessed in a live concert. Sometimes they're assessed by how close does the live performance match the recording.
Right.
Though there's also, you know, a lot more wiggle room in popular music for variances from the album recording. But, you know, really, that's what a lot of people still go to see when you go to see a show. You want, say, Billy Joel's The Piano Man to sound like Billy Joel's The Piano Man that you've heard 100 times on the radio.
Yeah. To me, that just seems like a waste of money, you know, to buy a $200 ticket to... to hear something that is exactly like what your $15 CD or iTunes album.
But isn't that's what we do exactly for most classical concerts as well?
Yeah, I know. Well, there is the element of live music that adds excitement, but at least in classical music, you can get different interpretations of the same piece, you know. But it's true, there's just way too much emphasis on playing what's on the page and doing exactly what's written.
Yeah.
And in my own experience as a performer, we can work on the details so hard, get all those technical notes, all those runs and passages as best as we can, but you just have
that's
to...
That's not the music, really.
It's not, I mean, it's the music, but it's not, it doesn't fulfill the point of music, I guess.
it's the music, but it's not musical.
Right. That's how exactly. Yeah. And then it's like, what's the point of playing if that's your ideal, is just to make sure that the notes and that you do everything that's written in the script, you know. I feel fortunate to have had teachers who encourage stepping back from the page and really going for expression and for a performance that reflects who I am and what I hear as a musician. But it all too happens that musicians don't feel that they can be free enough with their performance to do something remarkably different. And maybe it is tied to money, you know, if you have a soloist, a concerto soloist, touring with a certain piece, and it's a standard piece, then audiences are going to expect to hear it a certain way. And if you deviate too far from that, then they may never hire you back, or you get a bad review. It's just not valued, I guess, in culture. Or maybe we think that we don't want it, that it's bad, you know.
Well, improvisation always has a potential for being bad and for crashing and burning. There's no question about that. And I've heard plenty crash and burn improvisational solos. I've played some myself.
Yes. Audiences, they don't value the risk that the player took.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't get any points for trying, basically. Which is unfortunate. I don't know. I really wish that the classical music world would shift more towards an importance on the spontaneous and the creative. And what I feel like I found is that when you talk individually to musicians, they all value that. They all say they value that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look at, let's say, like an orchestral audition where you have a panel of 7 musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And generally who ends up winning the job is someone who is the least offensive, I think. You know, they pick somebody who plays all the notes on the page. You know, they get all the quantifiable aspects of the music. You know, they play the dynamics, they have a good sound, they play all the right notes. But they, like, if they are at all creative and take a risk in their audition, that's like they get points taken off for that almost, because it's subjective and I didn't agree with that, that's why I think having Bach on an audition is kind of dumb.
Yeah, because Bach is, for our listeners that aren't familiar, when Bach was writing, they didn't have things like, they didn't necessarily have dynamics or like certain like slurs aren't written into Bach's manuscripts. They've all been added by later musicians or performers of Bach, or, you know, people who collect, musicologists who archive edited volumes of composer's music. So it's all, especially with Bach, it's so subjective. It's a very subjective performance practice. Like, you can have, and that's why I think Bach is actually one of the most interesting composers. And what's really interesting when you bring up Bach is that he was famous for improvising,
right?
As like, he was a working musician who would improvise these fantasies and preludes at the church he was working at, in Leipzig, I believe. And
and in his day, composers would expect the performer to improvise and add their own take on it. And maybe because it's Bach, we are nowadays, each musician is very passionate about their own interpretation or what they feel is correct. And the truth of the matter is, we have no idea truly what his music actually sounded like.
Yeah, we can guess, but I mean, it's hard. You can, like, and the closer we get to present day, the more likely we're going to have like accounts of a given performer's or composer's music. But yeah, with Bach especially, that's why I think I like the cello suite so much, is because you can listen to five different performers and they all have a unique spin. So it's ironic that it's in this sort of what we call the Baroque music, music that's typically associated with like detachment from feeling versus like the Romantic music of the 19th century. It's in the Baroque music that modern day performers are really able to convey a sense of self-expression, I think.
Right. That's totally right. Yeah. So since we're talking about improvisers in the past, I guess we can segue into our history of improvisation segment, which I will try and cut down. I have a lot of research on it. Basically, Western art music has its origins in sacred music and music that was sung in church and in chant. Mm-hmm. And it started as just one voice singing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all know. If you don't know what Gregorian chant is, if you've seen it on Monty Python and the Holy Grail, they have the monks. That's my favorite example of Gregorian chant. It also appears in that Justin Timberlake song. Is it Cry Me a River?
Oh, huh.
Yeah. So you've heard Gregorian chant, probably.
Even is if that you Gregorian haven't... chant? I thought that was just a 1-4-5-1 progression in the Justin Timberlake song, unless I'm thinking of a different piece.
Well, a lot of them are 1-4-5-1 progressions. Okay. But they use a chant. It's either chant or chant-like.
Yeah. It's a choir. Mm-hmm. So I will spare our audience most of the details of a thousand years.
Let's talk about Gregorian chant for a minute. So like Notre Dame polyphony is really seen as sort of the first example of this codification of Western art music traditions. In Notre Dame polyphony, you have this like really old manuscripts that actually write down these chants, and what you have is like one note, usually it's a drone, and then you have an upper voice, sort of what seems to be an improvisation above this sort of drone lower voice. So
This is during which century? This is like the 11th, 12th century, I think.
But you have to remember, like, before this book was, like, written, before it was written down, I'm sure there were several decades of improvising leading up to that point.
Right.
Where monks typically would probably be, like, improvising these, what were one single melody chants, and then improvising them into, like, multi-voice chants with different sort of melodic lines.
By the time we get to the 14th century, notation of these melodies is becoming even more precise. So if you can write down more specifically what you want your music to be, you can also write more complex pieces that can only be figured out by writing it down.
Yeah, well, and you know, when you have something that complex, you have to limit opportunities for improvisation. Like Ars Nova... movement in France at this time that I think you're alluding to, it does not allow for, because it is so incredibly complicated and it's so complex rhythmically that we don't see anything like it until the early 20th century.
It's almost like mathematical the way they figured out some of it. Yeah.
The more complex a music becomes, the less open it is to improvisation, I think, is maybe something worth thinking about.
So hereafter, notation becomes more and more important to the composition and performance of music. And one thing to keep in, or to ask, is this a good thing or a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. And has advantages and disadvantages, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's positives and negatives to anything. Notation allows for more complexity to be expressed in music, and it also allows one of the other things about, say, the Gregorian chants is that when you have, it's almost like a game of telephone, when you have people conveying music just orally, then the chants are going to change over time. It changes right. over time anyways when we still have human copyists writing down music and copying notated music. Things change and copyists can make notes, copyists can switch things up. But it does allow for a more accurate transcription to be passed down from generation to generation.
There's sort of this drive to preserve what we create. So then by the 15th and 16th centuries, which are what we call Renaissance era, or part of the Renaissance era, there's more of a distinction being made between improvised music and written music. And in 1477, Tinctorius, who was a theorist, he made this distinction and said, basically, when improvisation happens during the performance of several voices, so multiple voices are improvising at the same time, dissonances are sure to happen. Mm-hmm. But when writing, when you write down your music, obviously a composer can avoid dissonance. So performer versus composer, you know, who has the control mm-hmm. over the music?
And that's really the question that I think has come to bear on ideas and the role of improvisation in the classical music world for the last 500, 600 years, really. It's been this tension between performer versus composer until we start getting composers writing specifically aleatoric works. But even then, composers are inserting ideas of freedom, performer freedom. So who's really in charge even at that point, too, in a way?
So in the 16th century, just more new forms and styles are emerging. There's more publications and treatises on improvisation are being published so that an amateur musician could learn how to do it on their own. There's instruction and examples. And up until this point, improvisation occurred only in singing, and there hasn't been any evidence of instrumental ensembles improvising. As time passes on, published music becomes the arena of the amateur, and improvised music is what the professionals do. Mm-hmm. So the Baroque period of music is typically understood to be the year 1600 to 1750, during which just more and more advances are being made in music and harmony. Composers are starting to specify which embellishments they want and where. So an embellishment might be like a trill. So there's still an emphasis on the performer being able to improvise. That's definitely considered a requirement. If you want to be a musician, you have mm-hmm. to know how to improvise. So actually, improvisation is becoming so elaborate, I guess. Players are improvising practically everything in the melody, such that C.P. Ebach, one of the 18 children that Papa Bach had.
J.S.
Right. CBE said, "One no longer has the patience to play the written notes the first time. The too long absence of bravos is unbearable." He's referring to the fact that in a lot of the pieces, music would be repeated, and some performers would just improvise both iterations of the music, and that really bothered him. So... So it goes back again to performer control versus composer control, and how that, you know, whose music is it once it's written down. Another development in improvisation are cadenzas. And would you like to talk about what a cadenza is, Brooke?
Okay. A cadenza is improvised section, usually by a solo player in a concerto setting, where the performer, the soloist, gets to show off. They're not supposed to be pre-composed necessarily, but nowadays a lot of composers do.
Right.
A lot of performers play pre-composed cadenzas.
Right, definitely. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we get to the 20th century. The cadenza is the opportunity for the performer to show off and show their skills. So during Mozart's time, Mozart was a child prodigy who was just immersed in music from the day he was born because his father was a musician, and just he was taken on tours across Europe all throughout his life and to play for royalty, and that's really where he developed his chops. Mm-hmm. Not just one instrument.
but many.
Yeah.
But most notably, keyboard and violin is what he was known for.
Right, right.
And it's almost like by this point, improvisation is kind of like, it's like a showpiece, like the ability to improvise on melodies is something.
Right.
It's not
definitely.
It's not like totally like a circus, like a circus sort of weird, bizarre showpiece, but it's getting to that point, I think, in some ways. That nowadays you can go to concerts where, like, if it's like Victor Borgo or like some other performers of that ilk, where people will shout out different tunes, and then
right.
The pianist, usually a pianist on the spot, will like compose, play some, improvise some fantasy on those various tunes. You can see there's even YouTubes of like, what is it? I want to say Jukebox Pianist is this YouTube series where this young woman listens to different tunes that followers recommend, and then she performs a spontaneous composition based on those.
Right. Well, basically, if you go to any piano bar, that person will be able to improvise usually. At the same time that Mozart is going around Europe and performing, opera has definitely taken a hold in the entertainment of the time, and vocalists are also being required to improvise. But if you know vocalists, you know that there's usually a certain kind of personality associated with someone who wants to be the star of the show or the star of the opera, and their solos are becoming, the improvised sections of their solos are becoming more and more embellished and indulgent.
Yeah, this is actually, as far as opera goes, this is actually a generation before Mozart in the Baroque era with opera seria, is where primary sort of soloist liberation is taking place in the form of da capo arias, where kind of going back to that C.P. Bach quote, where the people are tired of hearing the repetition of music, da capo arias are exactly, da capo means back to the head. That means you play the head of the music twice. So it's really boring to hear the same melody performed twice when your whole opera is made up of da capo arias and recitative, which is just sort of like the spoken, pseudo-spoken dialogue of an opera. So in da capo arias, these vocalists would improvise the second head of the aria, like playing, singing the same melody, but also doing a lot of different things with it. And sometimes even performers were so well known for like a specific aria that they would just sing that aria, whether or not it was in the opera or not. She's kind of awesome, I think. So yeah, that's really a hangover from, especially like opera seria associated with Handel's opera seria, among mm-hmm. others. And that kind of gets clamped down on, especially by Christoph Willibald Gluck in the 1740s with opera reform and the whole idea that we need to go back and limit these vocalists who are singing whatever the heck they want and bring them back to the musical drama, dramatic narrative, and that music needs to be in service of the narrative when it comes to opera.
Right.
Now, so Gluck clamps down on it, and then in the 19th century, again, we have sort of the rise of the virtuoso soloist, and it gets clamped down on again with particularly Wagner.
Yeah, you can't keep him down.
Yeah. So I want to hop in here.
Okay.
As sort of a precursor to Liszt, and Liszt especially, Chopin less so, Paganini really set the stage for the concertizing virtuoso. Paganini was a famous violinist in the first half of the 19th century.
Right.
He made a very, very big name for himself on the violin, performing works that he composed that showed off different techniques that he actually kept secret, most notably like how to do false harmonics. There were new technologies in the violin bow that allowed him to do different kinds of bowing that had never been done before. And basically it was astonishing to see him play. It's almost like seeing, you know, like today we have like in heavy metal, like guitar shredding. It was that level of astonishment and like technical prowess that astounded audience members. And he was particularly known for a kind of demonic aura that he cultivated. People thought the story like Devil Goes Down to Georgia, the violinist selling his soul to the devil. Well, that was a story that Paganini cultivated about himself. He also had a disease that deformed his fingers. So his fingers were incredibly long and he was incredibly, he's very tall and thin. And kind of an interesting side note, because of his sort of story, the legend of him making a pact with the devil, he refused the final rites given by the Catholic Church when you die. So he was stored in olive oil vats. His body was stored in an olive oil vat for a couple of decades before he's actually buried.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah. Liszt actually saw Paganini perform. And that's where Liszt took a lot of his inspiration, because Liszt really certainly was he was the European rock star of the day. If you guys are interested in that correlation, you should check out this 1970s film, Listomania, that has, I want to say, Robert Daltrey playing Liszt, and it's utter madness, but delightful nonetheless.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Chopin was a little different. Chopin was known for improvisation as well, but also as a teacher. And Chopin was as much a showman as Liszt in some ways, but much more known for the performing in the Parisian salon circle rather than like touring Europe as much. I feel like.
I'm not sure.
That's the impression I've got, that both very all three, Paganini, Chopin, Liszt, all very accomplished improvisers.
Right. So what I found from the Grove Music Online dictionary or encyclopedia is that improvisation during the 19th century, its demise, according to the writer, was caused by a lack of artistic quality and composition becoming even more separate from performance, and composers wanting more control over their work. And the music is moving away from being dependent on the underlying harmonies, and it's shifting towards a more programmatic structure based on melody, so that the music they're writing music to tell a story, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I can see definitely, going back to the composer-performer tension, there's always been that, and composers always want more control and say over how their work is displayed in public. Certainly, like I said, Wagner was one of the leading proponents of that. One thing that is interesting about, the dissolution of harmonic structures, because, going back to the Baroque times, when we were talking about Palestrina and Bach and Tinctorius, when you do have set harmonic rules, it's easier to improvise when you actually are working within a set of rules. As music does break down, like Wagner, and then later Debussy, breaking down the rules of tonality makes, in some ways, improvising much more difficult. I can see that, which is ironic in a way. You would think improvising would be easier.
Set you free.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. So then, when we get to the 20th century, we have symphonic composers like Mahler writing extremely specific directions in their music.
Mm-hmm. Strauss, too, yeah.
Very much Strauss. And there's less...
Richard Strauss,
not the Blue Danube composer. And there's less emphasis in training on needing to learn how to improvise. But in the 20th century, there are new forms developing. Obviously, jazz is one of them. Mm-hmm.
Jazz really grew out of blues.
Right.
So,
but you also have instrumental accompaniments to silent films, which mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about in the film music episode. In art music, there are more and more rules being imposed on music, and this is exemplified in Arnold Schoenberg's 12-tone technique, which we just found out, we looked it up, was in 1921. So this is post-World War I, when many, many artists and musicians are reacting to the horrific events of the war. And I was thinking, they're making art in a new way. Like they themselves, the artists, have been changed by the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so their art is going to change as well. And is this imposition of rules as a reaction to that? So the war, they felt like they had no control over it. They lost all control over their lives. And so this is a reaction to bring some order back into their lives to help them cope with that.
Yeah, I can see that. I also think because the 12-tone method is sort of like it's a way of composing, easing the compositional practice of atonal music. Atonal music had existed before 12-tone serialism, but as Schoenberg and some of his students discovered early on, it's very, very difficult to write atonal music, especially when you've been steeped in a total idiom for your whole life. Now, when you try to write an atonal 12-note line, you always wind up with some sort of gestures towards tonality. Schoenberg a really long time to write his free atonal piece, Perrault Lunaire. And then one of his students, Webern's, practiced free tonality as well, but his pieces are all incredibly short. because writing an extended free atonal piece without this kind of structural system and approach is incredibly difficult. So I think in some way you're right about, like, it's a way of bringing structure and order at a time when there was not much to be had. But I also think it's a way of breaking with the past structures and tonal systems.
Right.
So it's also a rejection of the past to an extent. But then again, like, Schoenberg saw himself as building on the history of German music. He saw himself as a continuation of sort of the Brahmsian music style. So it's interesting.
And then there were some composers who, in reaction to all of these rules, had to improvise in order to find a new way forward. And John Cage is a perfect example of this.
And he was working in the 40s.
He was working in the 40s, yeah. I always feel like he's a composer that comes along later, but he's not. His music had such an influence on later composers, but he himself was doing work in the 40s, which is really incredible, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Sonata and Interludes is around, the mid-40s, I want to say. That was his real breakout piece. Though it didn't really have much, it didn't incorporate the improvisational aspects that his later works did. As far as improvising goes, I think he really brought to bear the idea of releasing composer control, the composer relinquishing control to the performers or to his audience. This is most famously exemplified by his piece 4:33, that is ostensibly 4:33 of silence. And his point was that, well, one, there's no such thing as silence, and two, that it's the audience that makes the music in a way. The coughs, the giggles, the crackling of a candy wrapper. These are all, if we listen to them, a kind of musical improvisation. Is what Cage, I think, was getting at in part in that piece.
Right. He really broadens the definition of music, right? And sound. All sound is music.
Mm-hmm. As far as improvising, like, how does a composer improvise is something that's really interesting. Like, is it all an improvisation where you test methods and you play it at the piano and say no? Like, you think of in movies, like, composer plays at the piano, he's like, no, 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 and then he plays it again. Yes, yes, yes. And I keep saying he because, like, basically all depictions of improvisers outside of our opera singers maybe have been men in our culture.
Right, yeah.
But Cage did something interesting where he used coins, and based on this Chinese sort of fortune-telling book called the I Ching, he tossed coins, and the coins determined what notes he would write. So I don't know if that doesn't really count. I'm not sure if that counts as improvisation or not, but it was a way he sought
chance,
to,
you know.
Yeah, get release composer control to something else, though it wasn't the performer in this case, it was chance.
Right.
The coins themselves. But I think that that's sort of an interesting middle ground as far as improvisation goes.
Improvisation played a big role in music of the 1950s when composers are creating what we call graphic scores that don't really look like our standard music that we know today. It could be a picture of something and the performer has to play something that to them depicts what is drawn on the page.
Yeah, one of my favorite pieces by John Cage is called Ryulanji. It's named after a famous rock garden in Kyoto, Japan, and it's exactly this, where he's traced rocks onto the score and the performer plays these these rock shapes.
In the 60s, there's just in general more interest in non-European music and cultures. Mm-hmm. There's an emphasis on self-expression in Western culture in general. So musicians are feeling a freedom to do their own thing. And specifically during the 50s and 60s, you have an avant-garde scene happening mm-hmm. in New York City that includes composers like Lamont Young, Earl Brown, and Yoko Ono. Mm-hmm.
And these are all like, this is all kind of like sort of Cage followers, by the way.
Yeah.
Because Cage was working and teaching at the New York School. And it really, like, there's some other composers out there, but a lot of, like, Cage was specifically influenced by Asian Indian music and incorporated elements of it into his works. Going as far back as Debussy, being influenced by gamelan music from Bali even, but these kinds of world musics, Indian classical music, Javanese and Balinese gamelan, and later like African music, especially like West African drumming,
right,
become more and more important to composers working in this kind of art music idiom. And there's a lot more blurring between the boundaries of world music, Western style art music, and popular music, I think.
Right, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. As with everything, you know, there's a trend, and then the next trend is the pushback against the previous trend, right? There's soon, after the 60s, another separation again between composer and performer.
Really?
You don't think so?
I would disagree.
Okay.
Because for me, I think some of the most successful composers of the late 20th century are the minimalist composers. And they really grew out of this avant-garde 1960s world. Steve Reich and Philip Glass both had their own sort of what they call orchestras, but they were like basically 20-person bands in New York City.
But they're still...
And they're playing... I mean, they're playing...
But their music is very specific and...
Yeah. I mean, but they're playing... There's not improvisation. The composers are performers in these groups.
Oh, well, I think what we're trying to say is that... The two are being separated out again. Performers are not the composer still has control.
Yeah,
over
there's still composer control, but there's like the composers are also performers.
Right, but there's the performers who are not the composer don't have much input into mm-hmm. the music. I think though, like it's more like how it is right now, where a performer gets a piece of music on a piece of paper and they play that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, I'm going to go into this a little more on the Outsiders podcast, but in C, still, like, which is the first minimalist piece, or, you know, cited as the first minimalist piece, does have a lot of, it's got a balance between performer determination and composer
That's true.
Preconceived works.
So, but I guess it's moving away from, say, you know, Yoko Ono's pieces, which is like scream into a wall,
yeah,
scream into the sky.
Yeah. It's very different from what we call Fluxus, Fluxus works,
right,
of that era.
So then, you know, it's 2016 or 16 years into the, or maybe 15 years, I guess, depending on how you count it, into the 21st century. And so where is improvisation in classical music today? What do you think?
I think it's in sort of returning with the performance practice renaissance that's been happening in the last few decades, people looking to how musicians played music in the Baroque era and before.
Right.
So I think that's one aspect that improvisation has really come to become resurge in popularity again. Also, I think there's more performers interested in, figured bass notation. I have a colleague who's writing about figured bass in theory and how figured bass is actually a much more useful approach to teaching music theory to students.
Right, cool.
Jazz is taught usually, and unfortunately there's still some conservative academic establishments that reject jazz as a viable music worth being taught, but most places have a jazz band, have a jazz program, and the line between jazz and classical music has been blurred significantly in the last 30 years too, I think.
Well, and you can definitely, there are a lot of people who think jazz has been institutionalized in the same way that classical music has.
Yeah, it has.
So even there, right, it's not as outsider as it once was, and perhaps, I've never studied jazz, so I can't say with any authority, but perhaps improvisation, perhaps there are rules on improvisation in jazz as
certainly,
well.
There's certainly guidelines in improvising jazz, just like there was, as far as harmonic progressions go. There's guidelines that you can follow, but there's, I think one of the, improvisation is still an intrinsic quality to jazz. So,
right.
You're always going to have pockets of spontaneous music making in jazz.
What is also happening is a movement, I guess you could call it a movement, called free improvisation, which is there's a little bit of free jazz mixed in, and the two are often blurred stylistically, but this trend has grown over the years. There are now societies dedicated to it. There's the International Society for Improvised Musicians, which includes Pauline Oliveros, the flutist Robert Dick, and Stephen Nachmanovich. And there's the Stone, which is a venue in New York City founded in 2005 by John Zorn. And it's the venue promotes experimental music, where the venue itself is very sparsely decorated. It doesn't, it doesn't sell food or drinks. It's, you have a black floor with a lot of folding black chairs, and this is so that the audience can focus on the performance. It's a very small venue. And basically the rules are that, I don't even know if there are rules. It is extremely free. I don't think there's necessarily a harmonic foundation that's set out beforehand, but a lot of the same, in some sense, there's a lot of the same characteristics rules for the performers to follow, in that you give space to your other performer, and then you wait for your, for your time to say something, to play something, etc. So there's interaction, but it's all improvised. And now we have electronics being added to the mix of available instruments. I'm not sure, I wasn't able to find this out, but it seemed to me, based on what I read, that it's a kind of trend, it's a genre of music that you don't necessarily need a high level of skill to participate in it.
You mean electronic music or free improv?
Free improv. So you don't need to...
You don't have to be a virtuoso to play
music. You don't even need like a math... You don't necessarily need a degree in music to be able to participate in it.
Well, thank God for that.
There is... at least at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, improvisation is becoming a hot trend. They have started a new program called Roots Jazz and American Music that I think sets out to train musicians to just be more diverse in their skill set, and that includes improvisation, mm-hmm. which I think is a good thing. I think it's the kind of skill that benefits not only your playing, but your understanding of you know, structure of music. And I've used it when I've taught theory classes, and it helps. It's the glue that connects theory to performance, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's my. I hope that more and more schools take an interest in teaching their students this, because I think they will become even better musicians.
I agree.
Is there anything we want to say to close this out? Any thoughts, final thoughts?
Improvisation is awesome, and we should all do it more.
If any of the listeners out there have a chance to study with Christopher Azara at the Eastman School of Music, I think he does a summer class every year. Mm-hmm. It's completely worth it. He's an excellent teacher. He has his own method of breaking down the process of learning how to improvise, and it's really terrific, and he's such an incredible teacher, so I highly recommend.
I'll have to look him up.
Yeah, he's really great. He's got that TEDx talk also online that kind of gives you an idea of his approach to improvisation. He's the head of the music education department at Eastman, but his background is as a jazz pianist.
Rad.
So he's just a wonderful person to be around, and he gets you excited about improvising, and he makes it feel like it's not that, you know, that it's not that hard to learn. It's not just divine intervention, that mm-hmm. that there's a way to learn it, you know, that is comfortable.
Cool.
I guess that's all I have to say about it.
Great.
We would love to thank San Francisco Conservatory of Music for providing the funds to make this podcast happen. We really appreciate it, and we're looking forward to doing more episodes. That is all.
Ciao.
Ciao, baby.